We're going to wrap up today our series, God and the Movies, with the movie. By the way, my name's Matthew. I'm the lead pastor here. I didn't introduce myself earlier, so sorry about that. But we're going to wrap up the series today. We're going to look at the movie Get Out. And that's not a message, a subliminal message to anybody, but it's a great movie. And to help me kind of process the movie a little bit, talk a little bit about it, I've asked Melinda Anderson, our very esteemed chair of the board, who's going to come up and join me now. So let's give Melinda a warm welcome.
And also movie buff.
A movie buff, yeah. So you can take a seat there, yeah. Melinda. This movie, it's the movie's called Get Out. Has anybody seen it, by the way? A few people have seen it, yeah. So it's a great movie. We're just going to kind of introduce it a little bit, then we're going to show a few clips. The clips are going to move the plot along. I'll say now, we're going to give away a lot about the plot, okay? So if you haven't seen it, that's somewhat unfortunate. But I would say this, it's one of those kinds of movies that I think you may want to see again. So even with a little bit of information about it, I'd highly recommend watching it. And if you've seen it already, maybe go back and look at it. Because I think there's lots of sort of layers to it that, you know, kind of interesting. The movie, we've got a few stills just to sort of introduce some of the people. This is Jordan Peele. Jordan Peele directed the movie. He's kind of better known really as one of the comedy duo, Key and Peele, right? Has anybody seen any of their stuff? Yeah, Keegan-Michael Key and Jordan Peele. They're kind of a duo. Jordan Peele kind of, I think this is his first movie, right? First movie he's directed. And he began the idea for this movie after Obama was elected. And the kind of premise, or his premise, is that for many people would say we live in a post-racial culture, right? And he disagrees with that. And, you know, some of the evidence for living in a post-racial culture are the fact that we elected a black president. And so he started writing, thinking about the concept of the movie way back then. Didn't actually complete it until after the last election. So you could say a lot of water under the bridge, right, in the process of writing that movie. I think it's an amazing movie. It's full of all kinds of different genres. Okay, so at one level, it's a horror movie. Okay, so we're going to show a horror movie today. There'll be some clips from a horror movie, but we've kind of edited out any sort of gore and that kind of thing. But I would say it's a pretty gory movie. There's plenty of bad language. I mean, nobody says anything that every single one of us haven't said before. But, we can't really do that in church. So we've edited out some of the bad language. But I'm just giving you a sort of disclaimer. There's some of that going on. A little bit of violence. You know, it's a horror movie. It's also a comedy, right? And you don't get too many horror comedies that are actually at the same time serious. You know, you get a lot of things like Sharknado. Has anybody ever seen Sharknado? Yeah, an amazing movie. Yeah. But that's sort of horror and comedy, but it's not really legit, right? This puts horror and comedy together. It's satirical, it's social commentary, it's drama, it's thriller, it's all these genres put together. But it's a pretty in-your-face kind of movie. And obviously, if you've seen it, it's a movie very much about race. Now, a number of people mentioned to me when they saw that on the list, they said, oh, you know, I'm a bit worried about Get Out. You know, what are we going to do with that? Because obviously it's a controversial issue. To which I said to them, well, look, you know, it's Melinda and myself. We could be talking about money, right? You know, church funds. You know, that's what we're up here talking about. So, you know, you could take Get Out over that. So anyway, we've got this sort of mixture of genres. And it's about race, but at one level it's in your face, very obvious. But there, I think as we hopefully will draw some of this out, I think we'll see that there's some real nuanced layers to this movie that can be really eye-opening. It's a movie really very much about seeing. Okay, so a big theme here is seeing and how we see and who we see. And one of the prevailing images of the movie, actually, I think we can put it up, is Daniel Kaluuya, the guy who plays the lead role. He plays the role of Chris in the movie. You know, he's got these amazing eyes. And in many respects, we see this movie through his eyes, kind of in the first person. But we also see him seeing things. And he's a photographer. His character in the movie, he's a photographer, and you know he has an eye for things, and he's able to see insightfully and empathetically through his photography. But there's also an element of seeing where we look at things and we don't really see empathetically, or we see in a very sort of objective, removed kind of way. There's a scene, for instance, we're not going to see it, where he is, as a young child, he's watching the TV while his mother is dying. She's disappeared. He doesn't know where she is. But there's that sort of, you know, escape in seeing. And there's lots of screens in this movie. If you again watch it again, there's screens on the telephone, you know, the phone, on people watching TV, people seeing things through video cameras, seeing them through their phones, and so in a way we're watching people seeing, and so you know the premise of the movie I think is how do we see, and it gets at this issue of empathy, and I think it's making the case, and it certainly. Melinda and I are going to make the case about the movie today, that the movie is all about, at the heart of the challenges over race and racism is the issue of empathy. Can we really see as the other person sees? Do we see another person as other, as separate from us, and maybe sympathize, but objectify? Maybe even admire, but still objectify? Or can we actually see through their eyes? Can we in some way empathize at a level where we kind of can make that much deeper connection? And I would say this, that the movie, I think, is very challenging. I think it's very challenging to white people, okay? And so there might be aspects of the movie, not necessarily in things we show today, but as you watch it, that make you sort of recoil a little bit. I would say this, the irony is we're seeing a movie about empathy. We're seeing a movie made by an African-American guy. And he's telling a story, and he's giving us some insight into how he sees and how he experiences life in this culture. So the challenge is to us is not necessarily to so much evaluate what's right, what's wrong, all that can't be true, but rather to empathize, to kind of enter into, okay, this is his experience. He's telling us a story because of his experience. So I think that's the main challenge there. So that's kind of how we're going to approach the movie. Just want to introduce a few of the characters, and then we'll have a scene that kind of sets the plot up. This is Chris and his girlfriend Rose, and the story really is about the fact that they're in this relationship. They live in New York, and they're going to go and visit her parents. And it's a kind of guess who's coming to dinner kind of. Movie in that respect. Here are the parents. This is Missy and Dean. Dean is a neurosurgeon and Missy is a psychiatrist, and that's kind of significant to the movie. Very well-to-do family. This is the real hero of the movie in my mind, Rod. Great guy. We're not really going to see much of him, though, in the clips that we show. But I think he's the real hero. He's going to appear right at the end, though. We'll show you a little bit of him right at the end. But he's a good friend of Chris's. And as Chris is going through the experience that you're about to see at his girlfriend's parents' house, he has this remote connection to Rod through his cell phone, which actually gets broken down at one point. I think that's about it for the stills. Okay, so let's just show the first clip, and we're going to take a look at when Chris and Rose have arrived. Is that, that's opera music by the sound of it. I don't know, we're on the wrong service here. Chris and Rose have just arrived at the parents' house. By the way, we have a problem. We've got a technical fault. This window is broken, so we can't close the blind. So the screen on that side may be tiny little bit brighter than it should be. Apologize for that. But Chris and Rose have just arrived, and we're going to watch the sort of beginning interactions with the parents. Let me say this, that Chris is very nervous. He's nervous about seeing the parents. He's nervous for all sorts of reasons, like you are when you go meet the parents. But he's especially nervous because Rose's family is white and he's black. But his girlfriend Rose assures him that his parents are not racist. She even says, you know, my father would have voted for Obama for a third term if he could have done. And she kind of expects that her father will probably tell him that as well. So let's watch the clip.
This is Missy's office. She takes appointments in there.
She's a therapist, right?
A psychiatrist, yeah. Yeah, it turns out people up here are just as messed up in the head as they are in the city. This is Jeremy. That's Rose's little brother. There he is.
I've heard stories.
Yeah, I bet you have. He's studying medicine now. Wants to be just like his old man. You'll meet him.
All right, cool.
He's up in Bali. That's pretty eclectic. I'm a traveler, and I can't help it. I keep bringing souvenirs back. It's such a privilege to be able to experience another person's culture. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you're gonna love this. My dad's claim to fame was beat by Jesse Owens in the qualifying round for the Berlin Olympics in 1936. Those are the ones where...
Owens won in front of Hitler.
Yeah, what a moment. Up there with all his perfect Aryan race. This black dude comes along, proves him wrong in front of the entire world. Amazing.
Tough break for your dad, though.
Yeah. He almost got over it. That's the basement. We had to seal it up. Put some black mold down there. My mother loved her kitchen, so we keep a piece of her in here. Georgina, this is Chris. This is Rose's boyfriend.
Hi.
The garbage goes under the sink, and now for the pièce de résistance. The field of play. I love it. The nearest house is across the lake. It's total privacy. Get it? White family, black servants. It's a total cliche.
I wasn't going to take you there.
Well, you didn't have to, believe me. We hired Georgina and Walter to help care for my parents. When they died, I couldn't bear to let them go. I mean, boy, I hate the way it looks.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
By the way, I would have voted for Obama for a third term if I could. Best president in my lifetime, hands down.
I agree.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's just sort of introduction. There's the setup. You meet some of the characters. And I don't know, Melinda, you have any comments about that particular scene? But obviously, there's something... not quite right about it. Okay, there's some uneasiness to it.
True, and I think that it kind of points to this idea of the well-educated, well-mannered, good white liberal, right? So there's this kind of feeling of the parents trying to connect with Chris, right? And engaging him in such a way that is often meant to be familiar, right? And so, like, if we go to the last scene where he says, you know, I would have voted for Obama for a third time, the presumption is that Chris will identify with that because Obama was black and Chris is black. Maybe Chris is a Republican and he didn't know but vote for Obama the first time, right?
Right.
But it's kind of this very well-meaning, but... underneath, there's this layer of kind of this string of microaggressions, right? Racial microaggressions in that scene, which are ways of connecting often with people, black people or non-white people, that in and of themselves are kind of rude, right? And presumptuous and really built kind of on these assumptions. For instance, and we talk about sympathy and empathy, in the scene where the father is saying, you know, my father had the honor of being beaten by Jesse Owens. Do you have the honor of being beaten by somebody?
Right.
Chris, he's kind of trying to connect with Chris. Chris actually shows empathy and saying, wow, that must have been really hard for your dad, right?
Yeah.
And he's like, nah, it was right. He was against the Aryan race. Well, okay. You know, it's kind of this performative allyhood.
Yeah. And obviously you raised that issue, so you probably picked that up. So, Dean's father was beaten by Jesse Owens. That's a significant plot element there. We also met Georgina and Walter. Georgina is the maid, and Walter's the groundsman or gardener. And there's something weird there, right?
Yeah,
I mean, that's all we can
is.
Say is that, you know, we're introduced to those characters, and there's something that it's a little bizarre.
It's also interesting the way Chris looks at Georgina, right?
Yeah.
Which is often happens, right? Because it's kind of like that, oh, okay, let me see if I can connect with you, right? Because I'm in this white household,
yeah.
And she's kind of giving him this stare, and it's like,
right.
Okay.
There's no connection, right? So we're going to show three clips now that move the plot along, and we'll talk a little bit in between each one, but you'll get a feel, I think, here for the story. So what we find out is that Chris and Rose have arrived at the parents' house on the day where, or maybe it's the day after, but where there's this kind of family friends reunion. The grandparents, so Dean's parents, are no longer there. You know, they've apparently since died, and but they used to always invite this group of friends over. So that's sort of continued on. So we're going to see that scene now as the guests are arriving and they're being welcomed. Let's show that clip.
Gordon and Emily, this is Chris. Chris, this is Gordon and Emily Green.
Chris, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, Chris. Nice to meet you indeed.
Oh, that's quite a grip.
Oh, thank you. You too.
You ever play golf?
Once, a few years ago. I wasn't very good.
Gordon was a professional golfer for years.
Oh, you kidding? Well, I can't quite swing the hips like I used to, though. But I do know Tiger.
That's great.
Super.
Gordon loves Tiger.
Oh, best I've ever seen, ever. Hands down. So, Chris, let's see your form.
This is Nielsen and Elisa.
Hey, how you doing?
So, how handsome is he?
Are you handsome?
Okay.
Oh,
not bad. Hey, Nielsen. So, is it true? Is it better?
Wow. Fair skin has been in favor for the past, couple of hundreds of years. But now the pendulum is swung back. Black is in fashion.
Pardon me, I'm going to take some pictures.
Sure.
Good to see another brother around here.
Yes, of course it is. Something wrong?
There you are. Do something with this.
Yes.
Oh, hello. I'm Philomena, and you are?
Chris, Rose's boyfriend.
Fantastic. You two make a lovely couple.
Thanks.
Oh, where are my manners? Logan. Logan King. Chris was just telling me how he felt much more comfortable with my being here.
That's nice. Logan, I hate to tear you away, dear, but the Wincotts were asking about you.
Well, it was nice to meet you, Chris.
Okay, so we're gathering that something clearly weird is going on, right? Something pretty wacko is coming on. We'll talk about that a little bit more in a second. But what are some of the things you observed there, Melinda? Let's just talk
there's
about
so
that.
Much.
Yeah, there's so much, and obviously that we only have time for.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. I'll try to be crisp. Okay. So there's kind of this objectification, like you talked about earlier, of the black body, right? You know, she's feeling his arms. She's making references to, you know, the stereotype, right, about black men's private parts. Like there's this black is in fashion, right? This idea of admiring, coveting.
And this athleticism.
And the athleticism, right, with
Tiger Woods. And, yeah.
All of that together, it others people, right? It's othering him. They're not seeing him as a person. They're seeing him as a combination of all these different attributes that they have layered onto what it means to be black. So in preparation for this, I saw this article, and it was talking about how Nielsen had come out with this new report that shows that hip-hop music is now the top most popular musical genre in America. And it occurred to me, and some people were in the commentary around it, were saying how hip-hop music is a musical genre that originates from black musical artists. I mean, that is the essence of hip-hop music, right? Around, you know, black artists talking about black struggle and all of that. And how hip-hop music is now so popular, but that doesn't seem to translate over to black people, right? And so there's kind of this disconnect between liking, for instance, certain kinds of foods that emanate from black culture, liking certain styles. I can't even tell you the number of people who ask me, can I touch your hair, right? Mm-hmm. Things like that are very...
People do that to me all the time as well.
I know you have that same problem. And so it's this kind of... essentially creating people as these, projecting your images onto people as opposed to really seeing them for themselves.
So, I mean, what I hear you saying really is that there's something, I mean, in the movie, there's a reason, there's a very specific reason
which we'll get into. But it has larger applications.
Yes, and so it's a sort of a very specific thing that has more generalized application. And it's around this sort of... exotification, if that's a word, or the an admiration, or maybe of certain aspects of black culture, without actually understanding what it means to be black. I mean, that seems to be the hip hop thing. Like, if hip hop is telling a story, that story has been popularized, but it's not really being understood.
Correct, and it's not being, and it's not necessarily. And in the movie, going back to the movie, they're reacting to Chris, and you can see him kind of bristling from that, right?
Yeah.
But it's also, the thing that I loved about this movie is that, and we'll get to this a little bit later, is that it's also familiar to him. Like, he's not like offended by it. You know, he's not like, what are you talking about? You know, it's kind of very familiar to him,
he's
because
kind of
it's something
wow,
that he's
and
right.
rolling his
yeah,
eyes. And
yeah.
yeah, so got it. So, I mean, clearly also there's an element to this that is... Let's look at the next clip. We're going to move on. So we're going to go on a little bit further in this party scene, and Chris kind of gets some fresh or some new insight. Let's look at the next clip.
Oh, hey, hang on, Chris. I want to introduce you to some friends. This is David and Marcia Wincott, Ronald and Celia Jeffries, Hiroki Tanaka, and Jessica and Friedrich Walden.
Too many names to remember, but hi.
Do you find the being African American has more advantage or disadvantage in the modern world?
It's a tough one.
Yeah, I don't know, man.
Hey.
Yo, my man. They were asking me about the African-American experience. Maybe you could take this one.
Oh. Well,
I find that the African-American experience for me has been, for the most part, very good. Although, I find it difficult to go into detail as I haven't had much desire to leave the house in a while.
We've become such homebodies.
Yes, 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 but even when you go into the city, I've just had no interest. The chores have become my sanctuary. Sorry, man. Get out!
Yo! Yo, chill, man.
Chill, 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 man.
Okay, so that's why the movie's called Get Out. So something has happened where this guy Logan has woken up in some kind of way and is aware that Chris is in danger, and he's warning him to get out. And that's that's why the movie's called that. What we're seeing here, I'm going to give a little bit of the larger plot away. As I mentioned, we would at the beginning. What we're seeing here is that somehow we'll find out more exactly how in the next clip. But somehow, white people are managing to transplant themselves into black people. So Logan, who we see there, we've actually met him before in the movie, not in any of the clips, but he appears in the very first scene. It's interesting, if you listen to the commentary, Jordan Peele wonders whether people make that connection to Logan in this scene and Dre, who he really is in real life, in the opening scene where he's kidnapped and dragged off actually to this house, whether they make that connection. And he raises the issue of, do we just see a black person or do we see an individual, Dre? We may have forgotten about that by the time we watch this scene here. So he raises an interesting question. But Logan is not who he seems, and what the family here are doing is managing to take elderly white people whose bodies are failing or who maybe want a different kind of physical experience, and they're being transplanted into black bodies. That's the case for Walter and Georgina, who are the maids. They are actually the grandparents of Rose, or the parents of Dean, who are now living through this African-American experience. We'll find out how that happens in a second. However, the question, what is your African-American experience, takes on new meaning in that context, because sure. That is initially asked to somebody who is black, and then it's asked to a white person who is in
performing
a black body.
Performing blackness.
Yeah.
Right.
So let's talk about that a little bit. At one level, that's pretty wacky, right? That's pretty wacky. Okay, so and we'll find out more about how this happens in a moment. But let's just talk about that question and the African American experience issue that's raised there.
Well, it's just so curious because it gets at, on some level, to this the curiosity, right? And the question is kind of satisfying the curiosity about what does it mean to be African American experience in a very detached way, right? And so, again, trying to draw parallels, like in the movie, clearly this is the scene where you realize something is like way off, right? And I mean, as a black person, I'll just say watching this movie, I realized something was way off much earlier, right? Like just with the way that the black people were acting in this movie just seems like, and the way they're kind of interacting with Chris,
yeah,
just seems a little bit, kooky. But then in this scene with Logan, and he starts with, that's when it's kind of like, whoa, what is going on here? But the way he begins to answer the question, for me, was, again, this example of a white person kind of asking a black person, okay, so, because it's fetishizing blackness, right? Mm. It's saying, okay, so tell me, in this very kind of academic way, what does it mean to be black? If I were to go to you and I say, what does it mean to be white? Would you have a ready answer for that?
Mm. No.
It's, okay, right. So it's kind of like in the reverse.
Sorry, I wasn't really listening.
Right. Not to put you on the spot. But I'm saying like, it's just the absurdity on some level of just the question in and of itself and asking someone to kind of like, come up with a reply to
yeah.
that.
Yeah. Really, to me, it gets right at the heart of this issue of empathy, right? Because that there is, there's essentially a white person in a black body, but they don't understand anything about what it means to be black.
Right.
So it's not about the body, right?
No.
And it comes back to your hip-hop illustration. You can have the...
It's like the consumerism of blackness, right?
Right.
It's kind of like, it's a white person in a black body bringing all that encompasses being a white person in society into this body. So it's like, oh yeah, it's all good. Yeah. I'm kind of liking it. I got a good body. I'm doing good, right?
Yeah.
It's this weirdness beyond the fact that it's a horror movie, but...
There also seems... It's hard not to imagine that there's... That this part of the story, this part of the plot, is a reference to slavery, a reference perhaps to... I mean, in terms of ownership of bodies, right? Mm-hmm. And the objectification of a body, just and what it can do, what it can perform, what it can accomplish. And perhaps also a reference to... we're seeing this movie through the eyes of an African American male, right? The African American male experience of how their bodies are treated, and thinking about shootings and the sort of value that gets placed on bodies,
right? And the dichotomy, right? And you mentioned, you know, like the shootings, right? And how black bodies are perceived in that context. And then on the other hand, you have like NBA players and athletes and how black bodies are kind of fetishized. And that's, you know what I mean? So there's kind of that gamut. And you actually see that in the movie too, like with the tiger reference, right? Yeah. You know, kind of like, let me see you swing. You know what I mean? This idea that, you know, which carries so much historical baggage that we won't get into. But it's just this idea that somehow you can divorce the person from their physicality.
Yeah. And the irony of this is that this is a well-intentioned... it's a movie and it's bizarre.
But
the point made here is that these are well-intentioned white middle-class liberal people who would not think of themselves as racist, who are actually feeling, oh, we love black people.
So
there's
that.
So that there's that irony there. And likewise, we're going to move on here, and I'm going to set up the next clip, because what it turns out, this party is actually an auction, and there's obviously references to slavery there, in that Chris is the new body that people are going to bid on to have their bodies transplanted into. So those characters we saw earlier, so the golfer, he wants to be able to golf again. So he would love nothing better than a great black body in which to golf. Maybe he can be the new tiger. This is an auction, and we won't show the clip, but you actually get to see some of the auction in the movie. What's happening? I told you this is a bizarre movie, but Dean is the neurosurgeon. His wife, Missy, is a psychiatrist. She basically hypnotizes people like Chris. Chris gets hypnotized in the movie, and sends their consciousness to what's called the sunken place. So it's kind of a way of suppressing their consciousness, and then Dean, the neurosurgeon, basically transplants the brain from the white person into the head, the body of the black subject in question. And so in this next scene, I don't think that happens in real life, by the way. Okay, just that part's fictional, right?
It's a fictional. As you're looking at people a little askance.
Yeah, look for the scars, isn't it? But we're going to see a clip now where Jim Hudson, who is a blind white man, who Chris has already met, and kind of, I would say...
They made a connection.
He seemed different to everybody else. But it turns out that he won the auction, and we're going to find out what he's after from Chris in this scene. And this is where really the whole plot is revealed. So let's just check out this.
Wait. Hey, Chris. How's it going, buddy? You can answer. There's an intercom in the room.
Where's Rose?
Oh, you dirty dog. Now, you You're one of the lucky ones, trust me. Jeremy's wrangling method sounds way less pleasant. I'm supposed to answer any outstanding questions, concerns you may have so far. Apparently, our common understanding of the process has a positive impact on the success rate of the procedure. Just let me just tell you what it is. Phase one was the hypnotism. That's how they sedate you. Phase two is this. Mental preparation. It's basically a psychological pre-op.
Pre-op.
Or phase three. The transplantation. Well, partial, actually. The piece of your brain connected to your nervous system needs to stay put, keeping those intricate connections intact. So you won't be gone, not completely. A sliver of you will still be in there somewhere, limited consciousness. You'll be able to see and hear what your body is doing, but your existence will be as a passenger. An audience. You'll live in
a sunken place.
Now you're in the sunken place.
Yeah, that's what she calls it. Now, I'll control the motor function, so I'll be
me. You'll be me.
Good. Good. You got it quick. Good on you.
Why us? Why black people?
Who knows? People want to change. Some people want to be stronger, faster, cooler.
Black is in fashion.
But please don't lump me in with that. You know, I can get what color you are. No. What I want is deeper. I want your eye, man. I want those things you see through.
This is crazy.
Okay, I'm done.
Okay, again, so lots of irony here in that. I mean, it's a movie about seeing, and this blind guy actually wants to see through the eyes of Chris here. When we met him earlier in the movie, he's an admirer of Chris's work as a photographer, right? So he thinks Chris has
a
great eye.
He owns like an art gallery
or
something.
He's an art dealer. He's a blind art dealer, right. Which is, again, a little quirky.
Yeah, a little
but
term.
So we don't have a huge amount of time, so just right. Couple of comments about this scene.
Okay, so
here.
For me, I think one of the things that stands out most about this scene is the way that Jim Hudson tries to distance himself from the other people at that auction, mm-hmm. right? So he says something, when he says, well, you know, they want to be faster, they want to be cooler, but don't let me in with them. You know, like, I just want to see through your eyes. For me, it's this... He's colorblind. It's kind of the introduction, or I would make the analogy to kind of colorblindness, right? Mm-hmm. Both literally and figuratively, right? In the scene where he's attempting to say, you know, I admire you, right? Like I'm not looking at you as a piece of property, you know, like these other people. But that in and of itself is biased and bigoted. You know what I'm saying? He wants to his body. You know, like I mean, how like. I mean, it's just like a distinction without a difference. And I've started to use, like a lot of people use color blindness, and I've really started to use their phrase color evasiveness, because I think it's much more precise in terms of the phenomenon of looking at people and saying that you don't see color, because it's implied that if you say you see color, that you're being, you know, racist. In essence, we all see color, you know what I mean? Mm. And he can't because he's blind, you know. But this idea of color blindness doesn't really exist. It's really evasiveness. It's seeing it and wanting to avoid it.
Yeah, yeah. I think what we'll do, because in the interest of time, we had a couple of other clips. We'll just hold those clips for now. The movie ends in a really interesting way. In fact, maybe that's a good reason not to show the clips. That we won't give you the whole ending. Does Chris get out or not? I mean, he's in a bit of a predicament there. But I would encourage you to go watch it. Maybe we can, Sarah, put that scripture up. I wanted to read us a scripture, which we actually looked at last week. Ethan showed this one from the second chapter of Philippians. It's Paul the Apostle here talking about the incarnation, the birth of God, if you like, God becoming human. He's quoting what was probably a hymn, a saying, you know, a circulated mantra of some kind at that time. And here's what he says: therefore, if any of you have any encouragement from being united with Christ, one with Christ, in other words, if any comfort from his love, if any common sharing in the spirit, if any tenderness and compassion, then make my joy complete by being like-minded, having the same love, being one in spirit and of one mind. So he's saying there, he's talking there about empathy, I think. He's talking about not seeing ourselves as other, as separate, not objectifying, but seeing and feeling through the eyes and feelings and experience of others. Do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit. Rather, in humility, value others above yourselves, not looking to your own interests, but each of you to the interests of others. And then he compares that to the incarnation, to how God sees us and how God treats us. In your relationships with one another, have the same mindset as Jesus Christ, who, being in very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be used to his own advantage. Rather, he made himself nothing by taking the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness. This is true empathy, right? I mean, being made in human likeness. And being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to death, even death on a cross. We'll just leave it there for now. So, in other words, Jesus's experience was not one of objectification. Okay, the we're following one who we believe to be the incarnate God, and that incarnation is not. I think sometimes we think of the incarnation, we think of God's approach to us as sympathetic, and Jesus, you know, God kind of patronizes us by becoming human and showing us actually that we don't do a very good job of being human. You know, like, let me do humanity for you. I can do it way better. And so it lives this incredible life. I think if we have that approach to it, it doesn't feel very empowering. But if we think of it as that, actually, this is God entering into our experience. I mean, empathizing to the point of death, even accepting all those weaknesses, all those restrictions, seeing, not just seeing through our eyes, but having that experience to the point of death, experiencing all that frailty. It was an abusive death. It wasn't a comfortable death. We see ultimate empathy here, and that's what we're called to. And I think this movie, I mean, it's a very challenging movie, right? It's hyperbole, right? As far as we know, white brains are not being transplanted into black bodies, right? So it's hyperbolic. But this guy is telling a story about the African American experience, and I think, especially for us as white people, this is the challenge that I feel as a white person: is I have to listen to that story. I have to try and empathize with that experience. The challenge, I think, the difficulty is that you could come away from this somewhat depressed, thinking, "Okay, so yeah, we get it all wrong. How do we begin to build these bridges? How do we make a difference? How can we take a message like this, the message of this movie?" And how can it be transformative? And I think that there's a couple of things, and we're going to actually show a clip from a TED Talk just to kind of wrap up, and this will lead us into communion. But I want to suggest two things. One is that we would at least do our utmost to empathize, that which would mean listening to stories. It means building relationships, having a connection that's not just an objective one. You know, it's one where we have friends and relationships with people of color and you know, whatever color we are, you know, people who are different to us, so we can understand and begin to see through the other's eyes, even if we don't necessarily see clearly at first, or maybe we're going to find it hard to see. But we have to make that attempt. And then we're going to show this clip. It's a clip from a TED Talk by Jay Smooth, who is a DJ on a hip-hop station in New York, right? He's in New York. Mm-hmm. You probably aren't surprised to know I'm not a massive hip-hop fan. I know that comes as a big shock to a lot of people. He also has a kind of a video show that I've seen a number of his videos, and he's a very, very passionate and interesting social commentator, especially around issues of race. His mother is a white Jewish lady. His father's an African-American man. So he's mixed race, and he kind of has, I think, some unique insights into talking about race. This is a TED Talk he gave where he's taking on the challenge of how do we even talk about race when people are labeled so quickly. People get labeled racist, people deny being racist, and there's kind of this ultimate divide where no dialogue happens. Let's look at this little clip, and I think it speaks to itself.
So I want to offer a couple of things that you could keep in mind when you need to remind yourself that I'm not supposed to be perfect when it comes to navigating race. And the first thing is that anytime we're dealing with race issues, we are dealing with a social construct that was not born out of any science or reason or logic. We are grappling with a social construct that was not designed to make sense. And to the extent that it is the product of design, the race constructs that we live in America were shaped specifically by a desire to avoid making sense. They were shaped for centuries by a need to rationalize and justify indefensible acts. So when we grapple with race issues, we're grappling with something that was designed for centuries to make us circumvent our best instincts. It's a dance partner that's designed to trip us up. So just based on that alone, we should be able to keep in mind that you will never bat 1,000 when it comes to dealing with race issues. And the other thing that we need to keep in mind is, as we are all imperfect humans, and as has been laid out in some of the other talks this evening, we all have unconscious thought processes and psychosocial mechanisms that prop up. There are many things in our day-to-day lives that lead us towards developing little pockets of prejudice, that lead us towards acting unkind to others without having any intent to do so. These are things that will just naturally develop in our day-to-day lives. So the problem with that all-or-nothing binary is it causes us to look at racism and prejudice as if they are akin to having tonsils. You either have tonsils or you don't. And if you've had your prejudice removed, you never need to consider. if someone says, I think you may have a little unconscious prejudice, you say, well, no, I did. My prejudice was removed in 2005. I went to see that movie Crash. It's all good. But that's not how these things work. When you go through your day-to-day lives, there are all of these mass media and social stimuli, as well as processes that we all have inside our brains that we're not aware of, that cause us to build up little pockets of prejudice every day, just like plaque develops on our teeth. So we need to move away from the tonsils paradigm of race discourse towards the dental hygiene paradigm of race discourse. It's basically... if I could offer one piece of advice. And in general, I think we need to move away from the premise that being a good person is a fixed, immutable characteristic, and shift towards seeing being good as a practice. And it is a practice that we carry out by engaging with our imperfections. We need to shift towards thinking of being a good person the same way we think of being a clean person. Being a clean person is something that you maintain and work on every day. We don't assume that I'm a clean person, therefore I don't need to brush my teeth. And when someone suggests to us that we've got something stuck in our teeth, we don't say, what do you mean? I have something stuck in my teeth. I'm a clean person. Why would you?
Okay, so I think that gives us a place to go. As we think about this movie, and the issues that the movie is raising regarding race, they're challenging issues, and I think it would be very easy for us to recoil from those issues because we don't want to think that we're like that, and we don't want to be labeled racist. But I think what this Jay Smooth talk is inviting us into. It's an opportunity, right? It's an opportunity, A, not to label anybody. To say there is a problem with race doesn't mean that we're labeling people as racist. To say that I have prejudice doesn't mean I have to be labeled as racist. It gives me an opportunity, actually, to acknowledge that, yeah, I have prejudice. I'm bound to have prejudice. And I can work at that prejudice. I can be open to it. So I want to encourage all of us, you know, however we, whatever we felt about the clips on the movie and whatever we feel as we've watched a movie like that, to be open. We having prejudice does not mean we are a racist. But all of us have to lean into the fact that we need to listen to the story of others, empathize with the experience of others, and work at the barriers in our own lives and the prejudices in our own lives so that we can move away from racism and to an experience of us, our own and in our culture, that's much fairer, that's much more healthy. And a significant portion of the population is saying it's just not like that yet. And I think we just have to hear that and see that and empathize with that. And for me, that's what the message of this of the movie is. We're going to move into communion. We're just going to close out with this. And so this is sort of reflective time. You know, we have gluten-free crackers and grape juice as bread and wine. And you know, communion is this time of celebration of unity, a celebration of unity, oneness with God. We've just been reading about that in the scripture. But also oneness with one another. The fact that we eat this stuff, you know, we say this frequently, we kind of take this stuff in, it becomes part of us. So in a way, it's sort of metaphorically us taking God in and God becoming part of us. But perhaps, you know, and removing that separation, but perhaps we can think of it especially as we take communion of the removing the separation between one another, people in this room, people who aren't in this room, people in this country, people in the world, where we would see a removal of the otherness that so often lies between us. And so as we take communion this morning, maybe it could be our heart prayer that we would, that God would help us to truly empathize. And there's probably all kinds of people in our lives that we need to empathize with. And it may not even be around always around issues of race. But that's the particular challenge, I think, this morning. However we're feeling, however uncomfortable we feel right now, let's cry out to God that we would be able to empathize. And rather than being afraid and pulling back from that, let's enter into it and trust God with it and trust that God, we're following one who took that risk themselves. God became human and took on all that challenge and the risk and unpredictability of that. Can we likewise do the same? I mean, that's very risky. But that seems to be the nature of the kingdom of God. So I'm going to pray, and then please come forward and receive the bread and wine here, or you can be served by the servers at the side doors. We'd love to pray with you at the back of the room if you need some prayer today. There's opportunity also to write prayers out at the back, and you can give your offerings at the side. Let's pray together. Lord, thank you for your incredible love. Thank you that you empathize with us rather than sympathize. You don't think we're pathetic. You don't pity us. You love us. And you want to live with us and through us and in us. So we open our hearts up to that now, Lord, that we open our hearts to that love. And God, we ask that we would love like that, that we would see like that, that we would feel like that, that we would risk like that. And so now as we eat this bread and drink this wine, that is our heart's cry. And we cry out for ourselves, and we cry out for our culture, we cry out for the world, because we see so much misunderstanding, so much objectification, so much otherness, so much pain. And Lord, we believe that's what you are here for. You're here for that. So we welcome you in Jesus' name. Amen. Please come forward and take the bread and wine.
choir. You have heard all our songs, how we long to worship you. Yet you've told us the offering you desire to do justly.